This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Cast Under an Alien Sun, Book 1 of Destiny's Crucible, written by Olin Thorensen, performed by Jonathan Davis. Chapter 1. A Change in Destination. The plane lurched, hitting the first pocket of air shear. He cinched his seatbelt tighter, and his grip on the armrests ratcheted up 2 notches. He wanted to close his eyes, but instead looked out the window at the last of the mountains. A dot in the sky appeared above the distant horizon, then zoomed larger, expanding as if to engulf the plane. Before his brain reacted, he catapulted forward. The seatbelt cut into his abdomen, his view whirled, and he slammed back in the seat as the Boeing 737 disintegrated. The belt held him to the seat as his torso, arms, and legs gyrated. Something hammered against his legs, turning him toward the girl in the seat beside him. Her eyes wide, she opened her mouth, but her scream was lost among other noises assaulting his ears. The man on the aisle was gone. The spot where he'd been sitting had turned into blue sky, brown and green earth, and pieces. He tumbled, wind tearing at his face. He had glimpses of open sky, felt freezing cold, and gasped for breath. Intense pain accompanied impressions of people, baggage, seats, metal sections, and the shock of contact with something, and then... 3 hours earlier, Flight 4382. We continue with boarding of United Flight 4382, direct from San Francisco to Chicago. Group 3 may now board. What Joe Kolsko heard was something closer to,
"Wack you boarded, I'd Flighty 8 and Rec Farm, Salaforsko, Shillac. Grove E, where you're ord."
He wondered if they deliberately trained the announcers to sound like they had a mouthful of mush. It took inquiries to a nearby elderly woman with gray hair and a man in a cowboy hat and boots for the three of them to come up with a plausible translation. Reasonably confident their group was called to board, all three joined the queue. They shuffled forward, presented their boarding passes, and snaked down the gangway. As the line of passengers reached the aircraft door, Joe looked up at blue sky and fluffy clouds, then back at the aluminum cylinder where he would spend the next 4 hours. The plane looked so small against the vast sky. Sweat beaded his forehead and plastered the shirt to his skin. Why am I so nervous about flying? It certainly wasn't because of the conference in Chicago. While it was his first presentation at a major scientific meeting, he knew his results were impressive. And once he started the talk, he could ignore an audience of any size. Inside the plane, passengers jostled for space. Joe's apprehension persisted. The elderly woman took her seat, then Joe went to his row. He had a window seat. He shoved his bag into the overhead bin and sat his 5'10", 175 pounds into 28A, slid his laptop and a folder into the seat pocket in front of him, and crammed his knees against the back of the seat in front. His attention drifted to Chicago and the huge annual week-long American Society of Chemists, ASC, gathering. Scores of simultaneous presentations would be held in rooms that varied in size from hardly more than a large bedroom to an auditorium holding several thousand. He'd based his presentation on a paper that one of the better chemistry journals had accepted for publication, contingent on what the editor considered minor revisions. He had resubmitted those revisions to the journal 2 days ago. The title of his talk, "A New Approach to Synthesizing Derivatives of the Thiopyrin Class of Heterocyclic Rings," might be nap-inducing, according to his girlfriend Julie, but Dr. Ellsworth, his graduate school advisor, thought the title and focus appropriate for the setting. Joe had developed a novel method of synthesizing cyclic bases, a class of compounds that included both the information-carrying parts of DNA and RNA and other compounds with important industrial and medical applications. Joe and Ellsworth had submitted a patent application and expected significant interest from chemical companies. In 2 months, Joe would give another talk, this one at the Western Chapter of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS conference in Sacramento. At this catch-all meeting for every branch of science and for any social and political issues impinged on by science, many presentations would be less about hard science results and more about implications and speculations. Ellsworth referred to them as pseudoscience, but Joe didn't care. The meeting gave him a chance to relate his research to a topic he found more interesting than his ACS talk. His AAAS talk, Alternatives to Standard Heterocyclic Bases in DNA of Exobiosystems, would address one of the basic questions in biochemistry and exobiology: whether the four bases of Earth DNA, adenine A, thymine T, guanosine G, and cytosine C, were required or the result of randomness in the first organisms that evolved on Earth. Could life have settled on other heterocyclic bases, A, T, G, and X, or even X, 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 and X, where each X was a different base from Earth's A, T, G, C? Joe's novel path to base synthesis used conditions both relevant to efficient commercial production and similar to the environment theorized to have existed on Earth as life developed. He had already prepared presentations for both meetings, but the focus this day was the ACS gathering in Chicago. Getting his advisors' agreement to reveal their latest data at the Chicago meeting hadn't been automatic. "Joe, you know what can happen if you reveal results before publication. I know the good reviews are encouraging and the requested change is minor, but you can never tell for sure. It's always best to wait for formal acceptance before talking at a meeting." While Joe had pretended to take everything Ellsworth said seriously, he knew Ellsworth always drummed into everyone in his lab horror stories of people being scooped by trolls at meetings who hurried home and published preliminary results to claim priority of publication. Joe understood the concern. Revealing approaches, much less results, before publication had a checkered history in science. Joe's reasoning and his insistence the conference was a chance for him to impress the academic community assuaged Ellsworth, and the title and summary were submitted to the meeting's organizers. Joe only felt minor guilt at his lapse in honesty. It was not the attendees from academia he was interested in impressing, but those from industry, particularly chemical companies. Joe's ambitions were limited to an interesting job that paid well, a secure future, and marriage in suburbia with 2 kids. He had seen enough of the rat race of grant applications and the politics of academia, and was even less interested in teaching the same classes to cookie-cutter students year after year. Neither Ellsworth, whose lab he worked in, nor the Berkeley Chemistry Department would be pleased if he left early. Their goal consisted of churning out PhDs after years of benefiting from cheap graduate student labor. But that's their problem, Joe thought, comfortable in his small subterfuge. In theory, only the journal editor and the 3 reviewers knew details of the paper. In practice, word of the paper was already circulating. Joe had been contacted by 2 chemical company recruiters with job offers. Each had a salary comparable to that of a full professor with 20 years' experience, plus generous benefits, information he had not shared with Ellsworth. He and Julie anticipated a further increase in interest once he publicly revealed the latest results in his meeting presentation. They would have to do some hard thinking if they got an offer they couldn't refuse. "Then you wouldn't get your PhD," Julie pointed out when he told her of the first offer. "No, but a doctor of philosophy degree is less important in industry than at universities, where they wouldn't even look at your application if you weren't Dr. Somebody. I've asked around, and there's not much difference between a master's degree and a PhD for companies unless you aim to become head of a division, or even of the whole company, neither of which I have any interest in. If we decided to bail on the PhD, all I have to do is withdraw from the doctoral program, and a master's degree is automatically granted, based on my first 2 years' work. Is sticking out 2 to 3 more years as a graduate student worth adding 3 letters behind my name? You know my feelings, Joe. I'm ready to nest and move on. And there's the other little item to consider. They had been living together for 3 years, with a wedding scheduled in 2 months, soon after Joe's AAAS presentation. Julie and her family were in full wedding planning mode, something Joe was happy to leave to them. Then, a week before Joe left for Chicago, a complication appeared when a pregnancy kit came up positive. They had been careless. Having a family was something they wanted someday in the nebulous future. Now, whether someday would come in 7 months or whether Julie would end the pregnancy was under discussion. The option of Joe having a well-paid job would factor into their decision. From his seat, Joe saw his vague reflection in the plane's window. What stared back was the face of a man 26 years old, of average appearance, fine mousy brown hair, and unusually light blue eyes. He accepted himself as a classic science nerd. He loved watching sports, but was not athletic, being too slow, too uncoordinated, too unmuscular, too lazy, and from an early age too reluctant for the physicality of team sports. Occasional hiking and jogging, spurred on by Julie's nagging, were his only vigorous activities. While Flight 4382 continued loading, Joe reviewed the notes for his talk. He lost his concentration when the occupants of the other 2 seats in his row appeared. A tall man of about 45 and dressed in a suit nodded a greeting as he sank into the aisle seat. The man rose again a moment later for the occupant of the middle seat, a teenage Hispanic girl. She said hello to Joe with a friendly smile and took her seat. They all settled with minimal elbow joggling as the plane finished loading. Joe smelled perfume on the girl, and when she bumped his elbow and apologized, he responded politely, then promptly forgot about both of his roommates and resumed mentally practicing his talk.
"Sir, please buckle up,"
said a flight attendant.
"Oh, sorry."
He tussled with the seatbelt, then loosened it to accommodate his girth. He really needed to lay off pizza so often. Never one to mince words, his fiancée called him Pudgy. The plane taxied to the runway and waited in a queue. When cleared for departure, the engines roared as the plane picked up speed and lifted off. Joe clamped his hands on both armrests. They rose to cruising altitude, and the engine noise settled to a steady drone. 3 hours, 55 minutes before they touched down in Chicago. Joe's stomach churned. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes.
"You okay?"
Joe turned to the girl.
"What?"
He pulled out a handkerchief and mopped his brow, then laughed. "I guess I'm a little nervous."
"Do you fly often?"
"Nope. Only my 3rd time."
"Then this isn't the best route."
She smiled sympathetically.
"It's normally bumpy when we cross the Rockies. But don't worry. We'll bounce around for a bit and then it'll be okay. They seldom lose a wing."
A mischievous grin played on her full lips. "Thanks for nothing," he muttered.
"It's quite exciting when we go through turbulence."
Joe's mouth twitched and he glanced at her. She couldn't be more than 16.
"My need for an adrenaline rush is limited to computer games."
He tightened the seatbelt. "Even roller coasters are more than I can handle, and they're only a few 100 feet off the ground."
"Then you haven't lived. I can't wait to try skydiving."
"Not for him. Nor bungee jumping, rock climbing, or any other inconceivable activities. Video games and watching sports were plenty of action for him. He pulled out his laptop and opened it, hoping she'd get the message. He wasn't interested in conversation, and especially not the sort that involved aircraft wings falling off.
What do you do?
Joe sighed. To work, he needed to escape this chatty teenager.
I'm a scientist.
He opened his presentation and turned the screen so she could see his slides.
Sorry, I need to work.
She shrugged and pulled out a book. Joe worked on his presentation, which helped calm his nerves. 2 hours into the flight, the plane jolted and his stomach spasmed. The girl giggled.
Turbulence. Guess we're over the Rockies.
His belly tightened and beads of sweat reappeared in his forehead. He put the laptop away, cinched the seatbelt tighter, and clutched the armrests. The plane lurched. Joe's seatbelt squeezed his stomach. Gasps and squeals reverberated through the cabin. Somewhere a child cried. The captain's controlled voice drifted from the address system. Please return to your seats and fasten your seatbelts. We'll have rough air for the next few minutes. His anxiety mounting, Joe's grip tightened. He opened his eyes and stared down at mountains far below. A wave of vertigo swept over him, and he raised his eyes to the horizon. A dot appeared in the distance and drew Joe from his thoughts. He frowned. A plane? His eyes widened in panic as the dot expanded to fill the window. The plane lurched sideways, and an explosion rocked the aircraft. High-pitched wails filled the air, and a flight attendant and a drink trolley careened down the aisle. Baggage compartments burst open, and bags became missiles. A second explosion sent shards of metal flying. A ball of burning fuel burst in through an exit door several rows to the front, incinerating passengers close to it. The inhalation of smoke stopped the scream in Joe's throat. The plane tilted, nose down, and the seatbelt bit into his midriff. Then the aircraft swung nose up. The seat in front jerked back violently, slamming into his knees. Joe stared at his legs. A femur jutted through torn flesh, and blood pumped from the wound in thick ribbons, but he felt nothing. He looked at the girl next to him. Her eyes were wide, mouth open in a scream that was lost in the noise of grinding metal and chaos. The plane cartwheeled. The wall across the aisle peeled open and seats vacuumed out. The suited man disappeared through the hole in the fuselage. Other passengers followed, including the cowboy and the teenage girl. Still strapped to his seat, Joe hurtled through the gaping hole, jagged metal slicing into him. Arms and legs spiraling like a puppet, he twisted helplessly as icy air engulfed him.
I'm dying.
He tumbled, caught glimpses of open sky, felt freezing cold, and gasped for breath. Intense pain accompanied impressions of people, baggage, seats, metal sections, and the shock of contact with something, and then... Chapter 2 Alive. He awoke. Not the instant awareness of being jolted by an alarm or the gentle rising from dozing in and out, but a gradual recognition of existence. All he heard was his breathing. Wherever he was, the air was odorless and still. When he tried opening his eyes, they ached. His whole body ached. Finally, Joe's eyes opened, and he stared up at a ceiling so white it hurt his eyes. He turned his head to the left, then to the right. He was in a room with walls of the same featureless white, with no hint of seams, tiles, windows, doors, or lights. He tried to talk, to ask questions, but a croak came out.
"You can get water from the tube to the right of your mouth," said a voice.
Joe turned his head and something touched his cheek. He opened his mouth and a tube entered. He sucked cool water into his mouth. While it felt good when he swallowed, it was as if the water fought its way over rocks. After several more swallows, it became easier. Finally, he pushed the tube out with his tongue.
What happened? Where am I?
You were in an accident and were injured. Everything should be fully functional.
Accident?
What accident? He couldn't remember an accident. He was on a plane going to the meeting when... The plane. Sitting. The man and the Hispanic girl. Looking out the window.
The dot. The dot getting bigger.
The impact. Everything turning to pieces.
His heart rate shot up as he remembered.
Do not be alarmed. Everything is fine. We believe you are functioning within normal parameters.
The voice sounded hollow, recorded. Functioning within normal parameters? Who the hell talks like that? I must be in a hospital. Where's the staff? He tried to move something besides his head. Legs, arms, fingers. Nothing responded.
Why can't I move? Am I paralyzed? Everything is fine. You cannot move yet because I need to speak with you first. Do you understand?
No, I don't understand, he rasped. Where am I?
The voice ignored his question.
What is your name?
Joe said nothing, his mind racing, groping for solid ground.
Please answer. What is your name?
Joe,
he mumbled.
Joe.
Your name is Joe? Is that your entire name?
Joseph. Joseph Kolsko. Joseph William Kolsko.
You have given three different names. Are they all equally correct, or is one more correct?
My full name is Joseph William Kolsko, but people call me Joe.
The rasp in his voice was fading.
Thank you, Joe.
Who are you?
He demanded, his tone hardening.
You may think of me as your doctor.
Think of you as? What the hell is going on? His mouth went dry again. He returned to the tube for more water and a moment to think.
All right. You're a doctor and I was in an accident. Why can't I move?
To keep you calm until we can talk,
said the voice with its odd flatness.
It had an accent, though he couldn't place it.
That was unusual because people from all over the world attended Berkeley, and he could easily identify most accents. This voice strangely lacked intonations.
I will allow a little movement so you can be reassured. Test your fingers and toes.
Joe clenched his hands, then splayed his fingers. He wiggled his toes. He wasn't paralyzed. He tried to sound calmer.
Yes, I can move a little. Why can't I get up?
In time. Please answer more questions. This is to check your memory. Where do you live?
Berkeley, California. What is your occupation?
I'm a chemistry graduate student at the University of California.
Where were you born?
La Mesa, near San Diego.
What is the name of the San Diego football team?
Huh? Who cares?
The name, please.
The Chargers.
Now I will ask questions to test your mental responses. What is 2 plus 5?
7.
The square root of 25.
5.
The cube root of 4,913.
Give me a break.
Please recite back the following numbers. 3, 5, 8, 2.
Joe complied.
3, 5, 2, 2, 7, 6, 8.
He repeated the string of numbers again, barely.
5, 8, 1, 8, 3, 6, 2, 7, 4, 5, 7, 5, 9.
Who the fuck can remember that many?
The questions continued, alternating from the trivial to the ridiculous. Joe was about to call an exhausted and angry halt when the questions stopped.
Thank you, Joe. Your mental functioning seems to be satisfactory.
Joe was too tired to respond.
You will rest now, and we will talk more later.
Wait. What about Samantha?
Joe descended into a black void.
Then, awake again. This time suddenly, still looking at the same white ceiling. Joe opened his mouth to call out and realized he could move his arms. He drew them up in front of his face to look at his hands, rotated the wrists to view both sides, and flexed his fingers. While everything worked, the pallid flesh in his thin arm startled him.
You may sit up, the voice droned. Be careful. You may feel dizzy.
When Joe tried to sit up, it was as if his abdominal muscles had forgotten how to contract. He grunted and pushed against the surface with his right arm, struggling into a sitting position. He was on a platform 2 feet off a floor. The voice was right. He was so dizzy he thought he might faint. He sat, head hanging, hands gripping the edge of the platform, eyes closed until his head cleared. The ceiling, walls, floor, and platform were all the same white. He was inside a 10-foot white cube, empty except for the low platform on which he sat. He looked down. He was naked. His genitals were there, but shriveled. His legs were pale, thin, and unmarred.
The accident. My leg. He remembered the bone sticking out, ribbons of blood. Now there wasn't a mark. What kind of hospital was this?
Joe, can you catch this ball?
Ball? What ball?
Something thudded off his forehead. A blue ball about 2 inches in diameter bounced across the floor, hit a wall, and continued to ricochet around the room. It wasn't the blueness that caught his attention, but the slowness with which the ball bounced and the height of the bounces. It was like he was watching a slow-motion film. That possibility was eliminated when the ball came within reach and Joe reached out and grabbed it with his left hand. Another ball appeared, red this time. He caught it in his right hand.
Good reflexes. Thank you, Joe.
He stared at the two balls in his hands. Then his fingers curled into fists. He opened his hands and gaped. The balls were gone. A chill washed over him and his breathing turned quick and shallow. A knot formed in his stomach.
There is no reason to be frightened, Joe. You are fine.
You were injured, but everything seems to be sufficiently repaired.
Repaired? Like a toaster?
And sufficiently? Sufficiently for what? He drew several deep breaths, trying to slow his racing heart.
Please answer my questions. Who are you and where am I?
Joe, I am a simulation of a human being designed to communicate with you.
Yeah, Joe snorted. And I'm Jim Thorpe, the greatest athlete ever.
There was silence for a few seconds, then, I'm sorry. You told me earlier your name was Joseph William Kolsko. Did I misunderstand?
All right. Enough of this shit. Who the fuck are you and where am I?
Joe, do you see the bar next to you?
What?
The bar, Joe, insisted the voice.
There's no bar.
Joe glanced to his side and scowled at a 2-inch-thick bar about 8 inches above the end of the platform and curving to connect to the two corners. It hadn't been there a moment ago.
Where?
Please hold on to the bar. Joe placed his right hand lightly on the bar. Do not be alarmed. Please hold on to the bar to avoid injury.
Injury from what?
His feet left the floor. Joe gasped and clutched the bar with both hands as he floated, attached only by his death grip on the bar, his mind blank of any thought except holding on. The sensation of weight slowly returned, and he settled back onto the platform, keeping a firm grip on the bar with his right hand and his left hand gripping the edge of the platform. His mind was frozen, waiting for an explanation. Finally, he croaked.
What happened?
The gravity in your room was adjusted to zero to prove you are no longer on your planet. You are in a vessel at a Lagrange point.
Lagrange point?
The part of his mind still reasoning drew from a classroom memory. One of the points in space relative to the Earth where an object stays in a stable position with respect to the Earth while they both orbit the Sun. He remembered the balance between gravity and orbital motion caused the stability. He thought there were several such points, but all he could remember were the ones where the Sun, the Earth, and the Lagrange point were in a line. Sun, point, Earth, Earth, Sun, point, Earth, Sun, and point, Sun, Earth.
That's not possible,
Joe whispered, another chill raising the hairs on his back and arms.
How can I be at a Lagrange point?
How do you think it would be possible? Joe froze. To answer would make the impossible possible.
Joe, how might you be at a Lagrange point?
Joe's brain seized, trapped in a vortex. The voice repeated the question at 30-second intervals until Joe swallowed and choked out.
A spacecraft.
Very good, Joe. Yes, you are on a spacecraft.
How did I get into space and whose ship is this? Ours? Russians? Chinese?
What do you think, Joe? Which of them could have adjusted the gravity in this room? Joe's mind raced, rummaging frantically for plausible answers. He was on Earth, and they faked the floating? No. No way to do that on Earth. And what about the slowness of the bouncing balls? Some secret NASA, military, Russian, whomever or whatever? Nothing fit. But it had to be one of these, didn't it? Joe's grip on the bar tightened even more as he eliminated all possibilities except one. The blood drained from his face.
Can you think of an answer, Joe?
No,
he said in a small voice.
Then what is left?
He was silent for a full minute. Joe was cold and sweating at the same time, his throat constricted, his heart pounding.
A spaceship not made on Earth.
That is correct, Joe. This craft did not originate on your planet.
I'm insane, dreaming, or hallucinating.
Joe scrambled for an explanation he could understand. Acceptance came only after more demonstrations of gravity manipulation, and when one wall turned transparent and he could see the Earth in full view. At first, it was a small orb of blues, browns, and greens. Then it grew closer, magnified, he assumed, until it filled the wall. He stared for some time, long enough to notice the view had the Earth's surface in total sunlight. The only way the surface could be in complete sunlight was if the vessel was positioned between the sun and the Earth.
This must be the L1 Lagrange point, his mind dredged up. So the sun must be behind us to get this view.
The sun point Earth Lagrange arrangement. Only when the wall changed back to white and his heart rate returned closer to normal did his mind accept as possible the option that couldn't be true. The voice was silent, waiting for him to initiate. He didn't know what to say or ask as his mind tried to gather itself.
Do you need more evidence, Joe?
No.
It must be true.
Or I'm insane.
After a moment, he said,
Hey, wait a minute. If you're supposed to be some kind of alien, how do you speak English, and how do you know about Lagrange points?
All languages can be understood with sufficient samples, such as the broadcasts emanating from your planet. I assumed your language was English, based on the position of your aircraft. As for knowing the name for the Lagrange points, among the electromagnetic emanations from Earth are education programs. Joe, you are on a vessel near your planet, both orbiting your sun.
Joe's mind whirled, unable to settle on a single thought for more than a fraction of a second before careening off in other directions.
When Joe didn't speak, the voice repeated.
Joe, do you understand you are on a vessel orbiting your sun?
You mean an alien spaceship?
A vessel not of your planet. Yes. An alien spaceship.
Who are you?
Joe whispered. I am a simulation of a human being designed to communicate with you.
The same statement, word for word, the voice had used when Joe first asked the same question.
Simulated. Designed. You mean you're a computer program or AI?
You may think of me as an AI, an artificial intelligence, as the closest analogy to your species' technical level.
Who made you? Who made this vessel?
That information is not important for you to know, and I am not authorized to give an answer.
Why am I here? What do you want from me?
A malfunction of the systems of this vessel caused it to accidentally destroy your craft. There was a temporary single subatomic systems fault that would normally have been corrected by redundant subroutines, except for coinciding with a routine reboot of a process whose role was monitoring the reliability of subroutines. Unable to confirm reliability, blocks of subroutines shut down or paused, affecting both the vessel's cloaking technology, making it momentarily visible, and stopping the processing of external sensor data.
A computer crash? You're saying you crashed into my plane because your systems glitched?
A crude but accurate assessment.
It took 2 seconds to recognize the faults from the initial quantum error and make the necessary corrections. Unfortunately, in those 2 seconds, our vessel transited 38 miles and, for a brief instance, attempted to occupy the same volume of space as your airplane. Not unexpectedly, the attempt failed.
Well, no shit.
There were negligible effects on our vessel, but consequences for your aircraft were substantial. Our systems resumed normal function too late to avoid the collision. However, we managed to hold on to pieces of the plane, the baggage, and the passengers. Most of the humans died instantly, but a few survived the seconds it took the ship's systems to recover and attempt to save the plane. You are one of the survivors.
Was I injured?
Yes.
How badly?
Joe steeled himself. It is not necessary for you to have that information.
That doesn't sound good.
How many survived?
I cannot give you that information.
Why not?
I cannot give you that information.
You can't tell me how many survived, or you can't tell me why you can't tell me?
Yes to both questions.
Why am I here? You didn't answer when I asked before. Why rescue anyone?
There is an obligation, said the voice in the same flat tone. An obligation to be acknowledged and mitigated as much as possible.
Why is there an obligation and to whom?
You would likely not understand if I tried to explain. Also, it is unnecessary for you to know the reason.
I must be dreaming this, or else I'm going crazy. If this is all true, why do I feel so calm? I should be climbing the walls.
Why would you climb the walls? You have no physical attributes that would assist this action, and climbing would lead nowhere except the ceiling.
I mean, I should be screaming and running around, scared shitless.
I do not see any logical connection to feces. However, if I understand your meaning, you are wondering why you do not have more severe reactions to your situation. Part of the answer is that we are suppressing the portions of your nervous system that respond to agitation.
Joe was quiet for a moment.
You mean dampen the fight-or-flight response?
Yes. The hormones and neural pathways that energize your physiology to either flee from danger or attack an enemy are being suppressed to allow you to rationally accept events.
What comes next?
Joe asked.
Do you keep me here, take me to your planet, return me to Earth, or what?
At the edge of his consciousness were other options, ones he didn't care to consider.
None of those three options are possible. For reasons unnecessary for you to understand, you cannot remain on this vessel or be taken to my creator's home. Neither can you be returned to your planet. You have knowledge of our existence. You may choose one of two options. For you to understand the options, it is necessary you be given limited knowledge. I will not answer additional questions.
The voice paused a moment, while Joe sat waiting to hear his options. Fear curled over raw nerve endings in spite of the alien's attempts to keep him calm.
This vessel observes Earth and its civilization, the voice intoned, because there are other planets in this region of the galaxy inhabited by humans. Earth is evidently the origin of humans, though both humans and some animals and plants were taken from Earth in the past and transplanted to other planets. Who did the transplantation is not known. Humans did not then, nor do you now have such technology. Our purpose is to gather information to explain who is responsible and why this was done.
Humans on other planets. How many such planets and where are they?
I cannot give you that information. You don't know or you won't tell? I cannot give you that information.
Joe ground his teeth.
He wasn't in the best frame of mind for sophisticated reasoning, which was fortunate, since there seemed to be only one option.
Let me guess. If I can't stay on this ship, I can't return to Earth. There are other planets with humans, and since you're interested in my survival, the only option would be to take me to one of these planets inhabited by humans.
Partly correct. That is one of the two options. The other one is you can choose to terminate your existence.
Joe sat transfixed.
You mean like be killed?
You would cease to be. There would be no discomfort, I assure you.
Well, thanks, I appreciate the shit out of that.
I am sorry, Joe, but I am still not clear on the relevance to feces.
It's an obscure English language reference. I cannot give you the information to explain it.
Two can play at this silly game.
Wait a minute, Joe said then. I thought you couldn't give me information, but you just did, about other planets having humans.
As I said before, you need this information to recognize your two options and to make an informed decision. Will you need time to decide?
If you return me to Earth, I would swear not to tell anyone about what happened here, so your secret would be safe.
I believe if you considered this logically, you would see the fallacy in this assurance.
While Joe wanted to argue, he couldn't give any assurances that they, whoever they were, would have any reason to trust.
Besides, it is unlikely that anyone would believe you.
Joe bit his lip, eyes darting about. It was time to grasp at straws.
If no one believes me, why not let me return to Earth?
There is the low probability you would be believed, or your account would be on a permanent record that someday could correlate with additional information.
I'll never see my family or friends again,
Joe said in desperation.
Never have my life back.
That is unfortunate.
He blinked back tears.
Please, I beg you.
Take me home.
That is not an option.
I promise to keep this to myself.
There is no point in continuing this exchange. There will be no more discussion. You are required to choose one of the two options.
As if about to fall into a pit, Joe grasped for reasons to delay the decision. You haven't given me enough details. This limited information would contradict the obligation for my survival. I need to know more about the planet to decide whether I prefer that over termination.
The silence encouraged Joe to think they were considering his complaint, he hoped. Then the voice returned.
I will answer relevant and allowed questions.
For several days, as Joe considered his sleep-wake cycle, he asked questions and the voice mainly wouldn't answer. Joe soon became tired of thinking of whatever he was communicating with as the voice. He debated within himself, aloud at times, about what name to bestow, and he settled on Harley. The friendly AI of a science fiction novel by author David Gerald. For the alien, whatever they were, it was more difficult because he knew nothing about them, neither their appearance, type of environment, origin, nor intentions. Harley claimed his creators were only observing humans. That's what Joe would call them. Watchers who were benignly studying humans. He hoped. Talking to Harley kept Joe's mind temporarily occupied. Whenever the voice didn't respond or Joe didn't want to talk, he fell into despondent moods, even though he suspected that they continued to dampen his emotions. Periodically, a slot would open to a cavity containing cream-colored food cubes. They might be keeping him alive, but otherwise, the fare reminded him of papier-mâché in early grade school. Cups of metallic-tasting water were available on request from the same slot, and with instructions from the voice on the functions of several levers, Joe used a corner of the room for waste disposal. While Joe's efforts to wheedle more information out of Harley about the Watchers failed, he had more success with the proposed destination.
Joe, I am allowed to show you an image of the planet.
A white wall instantly displayed a planet against a black background. After a few seconds, the orb rotated to show the entire surface, and superimposed lines indicated the equator. Resolution was sharp, though no fine details were discernible. In the first view, major landmasses covered 40 to 50% of the surface, with a large continent in the northern hemisphere, three smaller in the southern, and islands were scattered around the larger masses. However, once the planet rotated, Joe could see the opposite side was devoid of land except for scattered islands. Ice and snow extended farther toward the equator than on Earth, and he couldn't see if the white covered land or water. When the view returned to the planet half with most land and stopped, Joe could see mountain ranges and the largest rivers and lakes. The land was shades of brown and a darker green than on Earth. Cloud cover was similar to that shown on satellite views of Earth, and several low-pressure whorls suggested the planet's version of hurricanes. There was no sign of human artifacts. Then again, would he have seen anything on Earth from space before megacities arose? He remembered the astronauts said the only single structure they could identify was the Great Wall. Wait, were there some pinpricks of light just inside the night portion? Several of them on the coast near the equator. Cities? While Joseph studied the image, Harley droned a commentary. There are significant human populations on all the major land masses and larger islands. The social and political systems are unknown at present, other than there seem to be a variety. The level of technology resembles Earth at approximately the years 1650 to 1750. Joe flashed on images of Stone Age humans, tribal societies, the Roman Empire, medieval Europe, Mongol hordes, and other times and places on Earth he wouldn't have wanted to find himself. However, by around 1700 they were reasonable civilizations. His positive attitude dissipated when he remembered that in 1700 on Earth, plenty of Stone Age and tribal places still existed, along with more advanced cultures in which he wouldn't have lasted long.
Where would you leave me on this planet? Is there any way for me to know more about the local conditions and have a choice where I end up?
No to both of your questions, said Harley. However, I am allowed to give you basic information about the planet itself. The planet is cooler than Earth, has a 329-day year, a day equivalent to 23 hours, and gravity 1.18 times Earth's, due to the planet's larger diameter and mass.
Making a rough calculation, Joe figured a year on this planet would be almost 9/10 of an Earth year, 20 years equivalent to nearly 18 on Earth, and so on. More disturbing was gravity. His 175 pounds on Earth would translate into 206 on this planet.
It's hard enough that I'll be dumped into a foreign society where I'll know absolutely nothing, not even languages, but to make matters worse,
I'll weigh more and be more physically stressed. I admit to not being much of an athletic specimen, but this will decrease my chances of survival.
Do not be concerned. We made minor adjustments to your body to account for the increased mass.
Adjustments?
Joe frowned.
What kind of minor adjustments?
We altered your physiology by increasing the efficiency of your cells' energy-producing organelles.
Energy organelles? You mean the mitochondria?
Yes, the mitochondria. The increase in efficiency should result in more muscle mass and faster reflexes.
I'm not sure I'm reassured by the should part. How does it work?
Basic Earth physiology is relatively simple, and it only required replacing a few genes.
You mean like actually replacing genes? Everywhere?
In most of your cells. Not every cell had the relevant genes replaced, but enough of them to have the same effect as a total replacement. The nuclear genome was too complex to modify in the short time available. Fortunately, the smaller DNA content of your energy-producing subcellular organelles was easier to change.
Joe didn't like the sound of this. Humans had nowhere near this technology, so how confident should he be that some alien race could do it in such a short time? Which brought forth another question.
Say, just how long has it been since you crashed into my airliner?
2 of your years, Harley replied. Jesus, 2 years?
Yes. It took time to fully analyze your biochemistry, physiology, and genome structure.
Since you were our first physical specimen of Earth biology, the repairs to your injuries were carried out with caution. The actual gene replacement took only a few hours.
2 years.
2 years. Everyone he knew believed he'd been dead for 2 whole years. As far as they were concerned, time had passed, and they'd moved on without him. Julie? Where was she? What about the baby? Was there even a baby?
One shock after another, and Joe stayed surprised at how he continued to accept everything with relative equanimity.
But after the previous revelations, what were a few more? It must be the drugs, or whatever they're doing to me that keeps me semi-sane. All right, so let's say I'll be strong enough to compensate for the increased gravity. What about diseases to which my immune system won't have any resistance? He rubbed the back of his neck. What about me giving them diseases? I may have latent viruses and bacteria that will find a virgin field. A whole population without resistance. I could accidentally kill off most of the people on the planet.
Joe thought about the devastation of the American Indians by diseases brought in by the first Europeans.
That is not a problem. As part of repairing your body, it was necessary to preserve your parts from external contamination. Microscopic elements were designed for your basic physiology and biochemistry, to exclude foreign entities, and were injected into you. You will neither transmit any microorganisms to other humans, nor be subject to external microorganisms.
2 simultaneous concerns intertwined in Joe's mind. He wasn't sure if he wanted more details of his parts that they had to preserve because they invoked scenes from grotesque movies. Then there were these elements they'd put into him.
Are these like the predicted nanomachines? Microscopic machines that could be put into a person to remove arterial plaques?
I know nothing of your species predictions. Such elements, or nanomachines, as you call them, are a normal step in technological development. What exactly do these elements do? They recognize and destroy anything not belonging to your body. This includes bacteria, viruses, fungi, or any other organism types, as well as any cells of your body that escape the normal limits on proliferation. The only negative aspect is that you cannot receive transplants from other humans or animals.
So, Joe said cautiously, if I understand correctly, I will not get sick, will not get cancer, but cannot have organ transplants. Correct.
Well, he thought, it wasn't like there would be any heart transplants with the level of medical technology on the planet, so it was a pretty good trade-off. No illness and no cancer. Joe hated to admit it, but given what had happened, they seemed to be making a genuine effort to do right by him, apart from his never seeing Earth again.
So maybe I'll have a chance to survive.
What about the humans on this planet? Am I correct that whoever made you doesn't want to know that they exist and are observing humans as you do Earth? If that's the case, won't putting me there risk revealing your existence?
It is estimated that the probability you will impact the civilizations is close enough to zero to be considered non-existent. It would be like adding a drop of water to an ocean.
Bastards. I just disappear and whatever obligation they feel is satisfied.
Over the next day's sleep cycles, he and the Harley danced around the topic of where Joe might be dumped. Joe's questions became more and more repetitious, and in one session, he was about to ask another question when Harley announced,
"It is time for your decision. Do you wish to be terminated or be put on the other planet?"
"Wait a minute, I have more questions I need answered."
"There are no more questions for which you need answers. Only questions to which you want answers."
"What if I'm not ready to make the decision?"
"It is estimated that there is a 93% probability your decision will not change by any amount of additional information. Nor would additional information increase your survival probability. Therefore, it is necessary for you to decide."
"And if I don't decide?"
"Then our obligation to you is ended. If you refuse to decide, the decision will be made by a random procedure."
"Meaning you'll flip a coin to see if I live or die?"
"If I understand the reference, yes."
"Christ. Then I choose the planet. How long will it be before we..."
Joe slipped into unconsciousness. Chapter 3. Planet Anyar.
Predi City, Island of Cadellium.
Lieutenant Bortor Nestor stopped at the office door of General Okun Akuyan, commander of all Narthani forces and civilians on the island of Cadellium. The young officer ran one hand over his uniform to check buttons and smooth wrinkles. Satisfied, he raised a hand to knock, gauged the appropriate firmness expected by General Akuyan, and executed 3 firm raps.
"Come in," said a baritone voice.
Nestor opened the door and walked to attention in front of the general's desk. On first impression, Okun Akuyan appeared stern and humorless, a carefully crafted facade. As a young officer, he determined that a serious demeanor served well in rising through the Narthani hierarchy. He was uncertain whether it had helped, but it was an ingrained part of his public persona.
"A message from Admiral Kalkan, General," said the young officer, holding out a folded and sealed single sheet.
"Thank you, Lieutenant," said Akuyan. He took the message, broke the seal, and his eyes scanned the sheet.
That'll be all, Lieutenant. There's no return message.
Nestor slapped a right fist to his left shoulder, spun, and exited. Akuyan read the sheet again, slower this time, absent-mindedly running a hand from scalp to chin. Of average height and with lean frame and face, he wore his hair cropped, just noticeable with the patches of gray, appropriate for his 52 years. Though he was smooth-shaven himself, many Narthani men sported mustaches, though nothing resembling a beard. No Narthani remembered that their distant nomadic ancestors had suffered facial fungal infections when they came roaring out of the harsh northern wastelands and mountains of the Melosian continent to capture more hospitable lands from weaker tribes. The beards, practical in their cold ancestral homelands, became breeding grounds for germs when the Narthani reached the warmer and more humid central latitudes. Shaving the beard solved the problem. Now the Narthani considered beards a feature of lesser peoples. It was typical of their arrogance to ignore a history not fitting their self-image of inherent superiority. Okun Akuyan rose and walked to his office window. In the glass he saw two faint reflections. His own face and the 6-foot-square wall map hanging behind his desk. He knew every detail of the map. The Cadellium Archipelago consisted of one large island, 2 smaller islands to the northwest, and several islets off the main island's coasts. That large island, Cadellium, measured 500 by 400 miles and was politically divided among 21 provinces ruled by clans steadfast in guarding their independence. A total island population, estimated at 800,000, seemed to the Narthani ridiculously underpopulated for the richness of the land. Through the window glass and past the reflections, Akuyan surveyed parts of Predi City, the original capital Predi Province, and the main trading port for Cadellium. The city's population of 35,000 was 9,000 more than when the Narthani first arrived, and when the majority of the population were members of the Predi clan. Now, only 3,000 to 4,000 clansmen remained. The replacements were Narthani civilian settlers and tradesmen and their families, members of the military accompanied by a few families of the higher ranks, and slaves from conquered lands. His eyes moved past the busy square and street in front of his headquarters and on to the main object of his attention, the harbor of Predi City. He drew a deep breath, suppressing the excitement surging through him. Troop transports and cargo ships filled the harbor. A row of protective frigates anchored farther offshore, their sails furled, the closed gun ports for their single deck of 30-pounder cannon visible from his office. No larger escorts were deemed necessary because Cadellium had no warships and was not allied with any major power. Akuyan's mission was to bring the isolation of this resource-rich land to an end. He watched with satisfaction as the first 2 of the newly arrived troop transports disembarked lines of men down gangplanks to form units on the dock, their dark blue pants and maroon coats identifying them as Narthani infantry. Even from this distance and through his closed window, he could faintly hear officers shouting at their men, boots drumming against wood, the clanking of weapons against metal canteens. All of these sounds rose above the background of thousands of men whispering, cursing, grunting, complaining, and talking with the next men in line. Cannons, ammunition, tools, more settlers, slaves, general supplies, and the heavy cavalry's horses waited offshore in cargo freighters. He again perused Admiral Kalkin's listing of the men and materials carried by the ships.
His forces were now complete. He drew more deep breaths, satisfaction warming his face. Everything was in place for the next phase of the subjugation of Cadellium. Cairnford, capital of Keelan Province, Cadellium. For Hetman College Keelan, hereditary leader of the Keelan clan and province, the morning brought no satisfaction. His forehead furrowed and his jaw clenched as he read the semaphore message. Another contingent of Narthani ships sailed toward Prethi City. A Keelan clan fishing boat straying closer to the Prethi province coast than advisable had made a good count of the number of Narthani ships before the fishermen beat a hasty retreat into safer waters. The fishermen reported their sighting to the mayor of the port town of Dornfeld, the only Keelan town on the Gulf of Whitlow, an opposite Prethi province. Word of the new Narthani convoy reached Kalich by riders from Dornfeld inland to the nearest semaphore station in Keelan province, then on to Cairnford. Dornfeld lay on the border with Gwilymer province, an ally of Keelan, and along with the eastern province Meetak, the three made up the Tri-Clan Alliance. The only semaphore lines connecting Gwilymer and Meetak to the rest of the island ran first to Cairnford, then north and northeast to reach all of the other clans except the Seaborn, the clan inhabiting the smaller islands off the northwest Cadellium coast.
Will there be an answer, Hetman?
Kulich's eyes rose from the sheet. The semaphore messenger stood 5 feet away, waiting.
Yes, Kulich mumbled, his gaze returning to the disheartening news, then raising to judge the height of the sun. If he got a message off to the other headmen, most should receive it by sundown. Not that there was anything immediate they could do. The semaphore flag tower stood on average of 5 miles apart, depending on the terrain, and were manned during daylight hours as long as signals were visible. The system had begun operating 10 years earlier, and only in the last 6 months had it connected to the last mainland clan. Rearranging the large panels took time and limited the complexity of messages. But a short communication starting at any clan capital, except the island province of Seaborn, could reach all of the other clans within 10 daylight hours. If past experience were repeated, most of the headmen would acknowledge receipt, but would not respond further. Too many clan leaders considered the Keelan headmen an alarmist, and in the view of too many headmen, the Narthani were far from their own provinces, so why should they care? Kulich's innermost thoughts, those that prudence prevented him from sharing overtly with all of the other headmen, were that failing to understand the looming Narthani threat was as dangerous as the Narthani themselves. Kulich hurried into the front entrance of Keelan Manor and to his office. There, he composed a 2-part message. The number and type of Narthani ships, and a statement that the ship signaled another sign of future danger from the Narthani. He folded the paper, sealed it with wax, stamped it with the Keelan emblem, and strode back to the waiting messenger holding his horse outside. Take this to the Cairnford semaphore station quickly. It's to go out to all other clan hetmen.
Immediately, hetman. The man jumped into his saddle, pulled on the reins to spin his horse, throwing fine gravel onto his hetman's boots, and spurred his mount toward Cairnford. Though Kulich's eyes followed the rider down the manor lane and out into the road, his real attention was inward. How many Narthani were now on Cadellium? And how many of those were Narthani soldiers? Thousands? Tens of thousands? He could only estimate. Since the Narthani had cut off all contact with the rest of Cadellium, whatever the exact number, every piece of news of more Narthani arriving felt like a noose cinching tighter around his people's necks.
As Hetman, he feared the future. He saw no reason to hope the Narthani intentions were limited to the three lost provinces. Predhi, which they controlled, and the neighboring self-sullen Iwal provinces and clans, who were now de facto allies of the Narthani. Why would the Narthani bother with Cadellium at all, unless they intended to absorb the entire island? He once asked his advisors, hoping they would argue. They hadn't. This fear stalked Kullage every waking hour, along with frustration at his inability to convince more of the other 17 clans hetmen of the danger. The clans of Cadellium had never faced such a threat, and Kullage feared their stubborn independence and distrust of one another might be their epitaphs. He sighed and returned to reviewing the quarterly reports from his district leaders. There was nothing more he could do today about the Narthani. He'd sent the news on to the other clans. Whatever the future held for them all, normal life went on in Keelan province. Even Kullage Keelan, the presumed alarmist, had no idea how wrong he was. Beach outside the village of Abersford, Keelan province. Brisk morning sea air moved on shore. The sun peeking above the eastern horizon had not yet warmed the air, its light just hitting the tops of sand dunes. Gulls and mervers cruised the shoreline, the calls of the former and the whistles of the latter creating a strange counterpoint. Yonkel Miron ran as hard as his 7-year-old legs would take him up the sand dunes from the surf's edge and onto the Abersford-Gwillimer dirt road paralleling the shore. He then headed inland through the village of Abersford. As he passed adults and other children, they yelled out, "Why are you running so hard? Is something wrong?" He ignored them, his lungs too committed to running for him to answer. He raced past the school his father made him attend 3 days a week and past the well-tended outer grain and flax fields of the Abbey complex. When he reached the 8-foot-high stone wall surrounding the grounds of the Abbey of St. Sidran, he sprinted up to the 20-foot-wide main gate. The double doors opened with the first chimes from the cathedral and remained open until sunset. The chimes had not yet struck, and the gate was closed and barred. Yonkel went straight to the foot traffic door built into the leftmost main door. Gulping lungfuls of air from his mile run, he reached up to the metal ring knocker on the center of the door and clanged it against the underlying plate. By the 20th clang, the upper half of the foot traffic door opened, and a cassocked, bearded figure appeared.
"Yes, yes, I'm here. You can quit banging now," said Brother Alber in an irritated voice.
"Brother Alber," Yonkel gasped, still out of breath. "My father said to get Brother Willer to come to the beach. Some kind of dead man or demon washed up. He's all pale and skinny and ugly. I thought he was dead when I found him. We were fishing when I saw him on the sand. I..."
Brother Alber shushed him with the waves of both hands.
"Slow down. Slow down, Yonkel. Brother Willer is attending to a childbirth, but I'll come with you."
Yonkel looked doubtful.
"Well, father said to bring... I suppose it's all right if you come."
"Thank you, Yonkel," Alber said dryly. "I'm glad I'm acceptable."
"Can we go now?"
Yonkel urged, bouncing on his toes like a hyperactive racer eager for the starting gong.
"Let me get my medical bag and some better shoes."
Alber closed the door, and within 2 minutes he returned, wearing walking shoes and a cloak for the morning dampness. His brown leather medical bag hung by a diagonal strap over his right shoulder and rested on his left hip. Yonkel ran ahead, stopped for Alber to catch up, and repeated this pattern until they reached the cliff above the beach. Below, Alber saw a cluster of people gathered around something lying on the sand.
They took the winding trail down to the beach and slogged through the soft sand about 100 yards until they reached the firmer sand where waves washed up. They approached the cluster of men. There, splayed out on the sand, was a naked man on his stomach. At first, Alber thought the man dead. His body appeared emaciated, and his pale skin had a grayish cast. Alber bent down for a closer look, then jerked back as the dead body twitched.
"Here!" he yelled to the others. "Help me turn him over! He's still alive!"
The watching men hesitated until Alber barked at them again. As they turned the man onto his stomach, he gasped, but no water trickled from his mouth as Alber expected if the man had been in the sea and nearly drowned. The man coughed, spasmed, and breathed. He wasn't dead.
"Quick! Gather driftwood and use your cloaks and coats to make a stretcher. We have to carry him to the Abbey."
The men scattered, and within minutes, four of them carried the man from the beach toward the Abbey. Yonkel and two other children alternated, running ahead and circling the procession. Word raced ahead, and when they arrived at the Abbey, two mendicant acolytes met them at the main gate. They transferred the man to a real stretcher and took him into one of the examination rooms where the mendicants on duty waited. Alber watched the examination, talking with other mendicants and Abbot Sistian Bainham, who appeared after getting word of the strange man found on the beach.
"Any idea who he is or where he's from?" asked the abbot.
"Nothing so far," said Alber.
After finishing the initial evaluation, Brother Elton Bolwyn wore a puzzled expression.
"Physically, he's in unusual condition. I know you say he was found on the beach, but I see no signs of that. If he had been in water even a short time and gotten washed up, his condition would be very different. There's no seawater in his lungs. His skin is unblemished. No bruises anywhere on his body, no cuts or lacerations. That part of the coast has so many rocks that if he'd washed ashore, he should have abrasions from hitting rocks on the way in. If I had to, I would say he was placed on the beach instead of being washed up on it."
Alber shook his head.
"The men who found him say there were no tracks near him when they arrived. The tide was just coming in, so any tracks wouldn't have been erased yet by the surf."
Abbot Bainham wrinkled his eyebrows.
"But if there were no tracks or no sign of his being in the water, how did he get there?"
Bolwyn shrugged.
"I'm just telling you my evaluation of his condition. How he got there, I wouldn't know."
"What about the man himself?" asked Alber. "What can you tell about his physical condition? He looked near death."
Bolwyn shook his head.
"He may look near death, but his heart and lungs seem fine. What's strange is his muscles. They've atrophied as if they haven't been used much for a long time. When we don't use muscles, they shrink in size. This can happen with people paralyzed in comas or confined for a long period. When I tested his reflexes to see if the muscles were functional, everything seemed normal."
"So," said Abbot Bainham Riley, looking at Alber and Bolwyn, "what we have is a man who, by magic, appears on the beach and has been in a coma or confined for months or years?"
"We're only mendicants," Alber quipped.
"You're the wise theophist who knows all and sees into the hearts of men."
The two had been friends for many years, and the banter between caregivers of body and soul was an integral part of their friendship.
"Oh, pardon, I'd forgotten for a moment. Thank you for reminding me," said the abbot, patting Alber on the shoulder before addressing the other brother. "Bolwyn, you believe he's in no immediate danger?"
"While his body is obviously weak, if he wakes up,
and if we can get nourishment into him, then maybe he'll survive.
I know I can always look forward to your confident diagnoses, the abbot chuckled. Let me know if his condition changes. Abbot Bainham took a last view at the pale body lying on the table. Well, well, he thought. Today, God has granted us a surprise outside our normal routine. We'll have to see what comes from this addition to our community.
Chapter 4 Recovery. Abbey of St. Sidran, Keelan Province. He awoke suddenly, staring at a white ceiling again, confused again. His first coherent thought was of home. Had it all been a dream? The voice, Harley, the plane crash, the story about other worlds and being taken to one of them. Would he look around and see everything back to normal? What if it wasn't a dream? What if he was still in the small white room with Harley? He looked closer at the ceiling. In the dream, it was smooth, pure white. The ceiling at home was smooth, but off-white. This ceiling was painted dull white with visible brushstrokes. Gathering his courage, he turned his head. He wasn't in Harley's room. A momentary sense of relief was replaced by confusion. Neither was he at home. Sunlight came through a window, the rays filtered through green foliage with leaves moving in the wind. Something flew by the window. Not quite a bird, but too big and fast for a butterfly. He heard voices. More than one. Perhaps a man and a woman. Human voices. Voices with tones, cadences, and hints of emotion. Multiple voices, not like Harley's cold, disembodied one. He couldn't quite make out the words, even when he concentrated. He listened harder, but still couldn't understand. He gathered his energy and courage, turning his head in the direction of the voices. The first thing he registered was a matronly, middle-aged woman with gray-streaked, dark brown hair pulled into a bun, her clothing a plain brown smock. A man stood next to the woman. He was younger, with a trimmed and frosted dark beard, medium-length dark hair, wearing trousers and a tunic of the same brown cloth as the woman. Their mouths moved and sound came out. Occasionally he thought he could pick out a word, but it was fleeting, quickly lost in the otherwise unintelligible stream. Oh, God. It hit Joe like a blow to his chest. Oh, God, it wasn't a dream. The man glanced in his direction. Their eyes met and the man turned to speak to the woman. The two came to the side of the bed. She put a warm hand on Joe's forehead while the man checked Joe's pulse and stroked his palm. Joe's fingers closed reflexively. It was too overwhelming, and Joe drifted off or fainted. He slept through the night and the next day, moving in and out of awareness. His reflexes seem good, said Brother Baldwin the next morning. Same with the eye focus. It's too early to be sure, but I believe he's come through whatever happened to him in reasonable condition. Abbess Deera Bainham nodded. Yes, but as you say, still too early to be sure. I did get the impression he was confused. Hardly unexpected, given how we found him. But that's something you'll have to deal with. I think I've done about all I can. Let me know if there's anything else you need. I'll be getting back to my other patients. Thanks, Elton. I can take it from here. Nodding, the medicant brother left Deera with the strange man. She was also a medicant, a member of the Medicant Order of the Cadellium Service Society. While both she and Baldwin were trained in general medicines, she was also the Abbey's chief medicant,
although in this abbey it was more a light touch of authority based on respect. Not that anyone didn't know who was mendicant in charge. Deira's title as abbess was due to her husband, and not because she led the abbey. Sistian Bainham was chief theophist and the abbot in charge of the three orders represented in the abbey. Mendicants such as Deira, Alber, Willer, and Bolwyn. Theophists like Sistian, who tended to worship and ceremonies honoring God. And scholastics, brothers and sisters who focused on understanding the workings of God's world. The fourth order, militants, focused on meditation, self-discipline, and martial arts, but were not represented at St. Sidran's, the Abbey of St. Sidran. Militants had never been numerous on the island, with only a few in the northern clans. According to lore, however, they were more prominent elsewhere in the world. St. Sidran's was one of the larger abbeys and had members from three orders. Smaller abbeys tended to have staff from only one or two orders. At St. Sidran's, the mendicant order was more represented than the other two orders because the abbey was the main mendicant treatment and training facility for the district, an area 20 miles across. The Theophist order at the abbey ministered to people in the nearby town of Abersford. In addition, Abbot Sistian Bainham was a prominent figure in the district and active in administering to the religious and societal issues within and beyond Abersford. Brothers and sisters of the Scholastic Order completed Sidran's staff and were in larger numbers than in most mixed order abbeys. Abbeys where scholastics gathered to study separately from other orders were also called scholasticums. Sistian had started his training in one until he became dissatisfied with the scholastics' tendency to interact within their own order and not perform service to God's role in the world. He switched to the Theophist Order. And when he became the abbot at St. Sidran's, he encouraged select scholastics to join them. He was eager to bring the different orders closer. St. Sidran's was also unusual in that a few brothers and sisters performed duties across orders. Another example of the abbot's reluctance to compartmentalize service to the people and God. The strange man had created a minor sensation, both in town and among members of the three orders in the abbey. Mendicants regarded him as a patient. To theophists, he was one of God's children to minister to, assuming he wasn't a demon. And to scholastics, he was a puzzle. And what was more fun than a puzzle? Deira touched the stubble on the sleeping man's chin. He had been clean-shaven when found. Whatever happened must have occurred recently because the stubble couldn't be more than 2 or 3 days old. Who was he? A slave escaped from the Narthani? The Narthani slaves were beardless, though she hadn't heard of a Narthani slave without bruises or scars. He obviously wasn't a eunuch. Rumors were that some Narthani male slaves were castrated as children to make them more docile. So was this mysterious guest a demon, sent by the evil one to tempt them, or an agent of God sent to test them? Deira returned to her duties, musing on how the daily routine had changed this day, and wondering whether there was any higher meaning to it. She and Sistian would have an interesting conversation over the evening meal. Responsive. The next morning, the stranger was still asleep when Deira visited him.
He did wake several times during the night,
the night attendant told Deira, and then drifted back to sleep.
At mid-morning, he awoke again.
They tried feeding him broth, but he turned away when the spoon came under his nose. By afternoon, he swallowed a small cup of phyla juice. While it was too sweet for Deira's taste, and she didn't care for the musty flavor, it was heavy in sugar and other nutrients. By the third day, he kept down a small portion of barley and beef soup. By the fifth day, he consumed large helpings,
and on the eighth day, the stranger sat up and ate solid foods by himself. He was still weak, but the change astounded the medicants. The pallor that had made them afraid he was near death had transformed into a healthy complexion, though lighter in tone than most Cadelli. They also confirmed he didn't speak any of the languages known to them. Cadelli, or any of the major mainland dialects of the same language group. Several dialects of Calardium of the Iroquinic continent, Frangelese, or Highlandalin, the learned language of the Landalin continent and the accepted scholastic language of most of Anyar. Deera felt trepidations when they brought in an escaped Narthani slave working on a farm near Abersford to try the Narthani language, fearing the stranger was either a Narthani or one of their agents. She was relieved when he was oblivious to the Narthani language as any of the others they tried. 5 days later, an impromptu staff gathering was called to discuss the next step for the stranger. A senior theophist, Colwyn Y, sat hunched over, lines of discontent scoring his dour face.
"Where is he from, then?"
Deera sighed. Y was a difficult, conservative man.
"We have no idea, Brother Colwyn. I sense he hasn't been deceptive, at least as far as language is concerned. Although he might be suffering from a mental impairment, my instinct tells me he's from a distant part of Anyar, where the language is completely unknown to us."
Brother Baldwin nodded.
"That's possible. It's not as if Cadellium is on the main travel routes or widely known on Anyar. He could be from an island population even smaller than ours, or some geographically isolated language enclave. All we know about him is his name. Josef Kolsko, if we are pronouncing it correctly."
"Josef Kolsko."
Deera drew out the sounds.
"I don't recall ever hearing either name." "Me either," Baldwin said. "Which gives more credence to his origin being somewhere unknown to us here on Cadellium."
"We should have serious reservations about leaving him unguarded," groused Y. "The speed of his recovery should be a warning that he could be an agent of the Evil One."
The others looked at Y with resignation. The stubby brother never faltered in his search for signs of demons and malefactors. While they usually tolerated his fixation, it was tiring. Baldwin waved a dismissive hand.
"Let's get back to the purpose of this meeting and our next step with the stranger. For the last few days, he's visited the relief room in the ward and sponged himself off."
He smiled.
"I didn't think he was up to it, but I suspect having people help him with voiding and washing his body makes him uncomfortable. His people may have stronger privacy customs than us. Since he is able to care for himself, I recommend he be moved to a room in the visitor's building. He needs fresh air and sunshine."
"And you think he..." Deera paused.
"I suppose we should quit calling him he or the stranger and use his name."
She glanced at Baldwin.
"You think this Josef Kolsko is ready to be moved?"
Baldwin shrugged.
"I see no reason not to."
Into a new world. That afternoon, two brothers helped Joe to quarters in a nearby building. The simple room contained a narrow bed and bedding, a plain chest with three drawers, a small mirror on the wall, and a window looking out at a garden and the abbey's main wall. There was one painting in the room, one that Joe suspected was a depiction of God bringing the first man to life. A flask of water sat on the table, along with a drying cloth, a sphere of soap, a comb, and a tooth cleaner, all of which the staff hoped he knew how to use. Because he had no clothes when found and had worn nothing but a patient's gown during his recovery, they had laid out two sets of clothing on the narrow bed, a pair of sandals, a pair of sturdy shoes,
Two trousers, two pullover shirts of the same brown cloth he'd seen worn by the people caring for him, and a brimmed straw hat. Joe had been nervous when two men walked him to a different building, wondering what was in store. When he saw the clothing, he took it as a sign they expected him to stay for a time.
Well, at least they aren't turning me out on my own, imprisoning me for being an illegal alien, or burning me at the stake. Yet, anyway.
They left him after pantomiming he should rest. At evening mealtime, an elderly brother, Fitham by name, if Joe understood, came to Joe's room and guided him to a large dining hall with about 40 tables made from light, grainy wood, some with 4 chairs and others with 8. The floors were foot-wide planks worn smooth. A variety of tapestries, pattern cloths, and paintings hung on the stone walls, among them a larger version of the painting in his room. He later learned the permanent staff lived in their own quarters, which had meal preparation facilities. The Abbey also operated the central dining hall for ambulatory patients, patients' family members, visitors to the Abbey, and any Abbey staff who either preferred not to prepare their own meals or wanted to join the others on occasion. When Fitham led Joe into the hall, the buzz of conversation died. Talk picked up again as the brothers sat Joe at a table. He ignored the covert glances from the diners. The move to new quarters and the walk to the hall were the most exertion and excitement he'd had since his arrival. He focused on eating hunks of meat and thick gravy over starchy chunks of greenish vegetables and generous slices of heavy, dark bread. Thankfully, the bread was familiar enough, although the starch and the vegetables were too much in the some kind of category for him to be comfortable. It didn't matter. His appetite had blossomed. He ate the portion Fitham brought to him in a round wooden bowl, and after he devoured the contents, Fitham, without hesitation, took the bowl back and returned with an even larger portion. Joe ate it slower this time. He thought his stomach might have room for even more food, but by now he was aware of the other diner's attention. Brother Fitham waited for him to finish eating and then led him back to his room. Already he seemed steadier on his feet. They stopped off at the large communal outhouse. Joe thought that an out chalet would be more descriptive of the elaborate facility. Back in his room, Joe undressed, lay on the bed, and pulled the covers up to his chin.
I'm alive. They're feeding me, giving me clothes and a place to stay. What's next? What am I going to do here?
With no answers forthcoming, he drifted off to sleep. Chapter 5. A Gathering Storm. Narthani HQ, Predi City. 5 men stood in General Okan Akuyan's office. 2 stood at the window overlooking the Predi City harbor. Admiral Morfred Kalkan, commander of all Narthani naval forces in Cadellium waters, and Nizam Tuzer, head administrator of Narthani non-military personnel. 3 men faced the wall map of Cadellium. General Akuyan, Colonel Ivek Zulfa, in command of all Narthani ground forces, and Sadek Hizer, who carried the title of assessor and reported directly to the Narthani High Command. Zulfa waved a hand across the map.
General, information shows the mountains of this island contain sources of minerals the Cadelli haven't exploited, either because they don't realize what's under their ground, or because they lack markets. And that's on top of the agricultural potential here.
All the better for us. Hizer shrugged and tugged an ear. Otherwise, some other realm might have gotten here ahead of us, like one of the Iroquinic states, or even the Fuomi.
I'm surprised they haven't, given the strategic location of the island,
Zulfa commented.
It may be considered strategic for us, but not anyone else. Yet, said Akuyan. The High Command is looking for options on how to break out of our current stalemate. The coalitions on our western and eastern borders have successfully stalled us for many years. Cadellium has the potential to serve as a staging site for direct action against the rears of the Landalin continent and the Iroquinic Confederation. So far, they haven't become aware of our interest in Cadellium, and we want to be firmly in control of the entire island before our enemies realize our control of Cadellium puts a dagger pointed at their backs. The other four men continued talking, but Akuyan only pretended to pay attention. He asked questions, but his mind was elsewhere. This was the traditional day of rest and worship of the god Narth. Narth Day, God's Day to the Gedali. It was Akuyan's custom to schedule an afternoon meeting with his senior commanders the day before beginning the 5 workdays of every 6-day. However, today's meeting was not routine. All right, gentlemen, let's start. Akuyan turned from the map and took a seat. The other four men followed and sat at the round table, shuffling papers, adjusting chairs, and clearing throats. Akuyan waited, his right hand on the tabletop, thumb lightly tapping the surface until the other four were ready. These men were among the best the Empire had produced. Yet only Akuyan knew their selection by the High Command was deliberate compensation for the poor quality of troops they commanded and the limited resources assigned to achieve their objective.
Gentlemen, as you're aware, there's only one item to discuss today.
His eyes went from one man to the next.
To consider the formal decision of whether it's time to move into the next phase of our ultimate goal here on Cadellium, bringing it into the Empire.
Akuyan's hand lay on his notes, though he didn't need to consult them. While he wouldn't be saying anything they didn't already know, he believed in formalities and clarity of purpose. The silence of the four men belied their anticipation.
None of us at this table were here for Phase 1, establishing a Narthani presence on the island. Granted, we've all studied the reports, but I'll review how we've gotten to this point. It began 6 years ago with the establishment of a Narthani trading presence in Predi City, the largest city on Cadellium and capital of the Predi clan in province. The city had an original population around 26,000 and was the center of external trade for the entire island, the source of the Predi clan's wealth. Our agents, acting as trading companies, established themselves in the city with the cooperation of the clan's leadership and traders.
Akuyan allowed himself a small smile. This part of the plan went so easily as to be absurd.
The Predi leaders, eager for our gold, either ignored or didn't recognize our agents as arms of the Narthan Empire. After all, money was money, and the cheap goods we supplied, along with contributions to Predi infrastructure and bribes to all sectors of the province, greased the acceptance of our growing presence. The Predi also sold us land adjoining the city for a Narthani enclave. By the end of the 3rd year of Phase 1, the locals were accustomed to having Narthani around. Though our people weren't liked, they were scrupulously honest in business dealings and took care not to offend Predi laws or customs. And that, gentlemen, is when it was determined Phase 1 was complete and we moved on to Phase 2.
Akuyan raised an eyebrow and gestured with his left hand to solicit comments.
This was a critical stage, offered Tuzer, shaking his head. The Predi could have rejected our opening ploys and made things much harder for us. However, I think the Predi leaders became addicted to Narthani gold, and it numbed their reasoning powers.
Now, Nizam, Zalfa smiled. Let's not be too critical. They did some of the hard work for us.
Whatever motivated the Prethi, Aquian said, our people moved on to phase two. Undermining the Prethi and the adjacent clans, Selsil and Iwal. Despite being the richest of the Cadellium districts, Prethi had one of the smallest land areas, the result of being on the losing end of a series of border disputes with the Iwal and Selsil clans. Aquian used a wooden pointer to touch clan territories on the wall map. By judiciously manipulating trade and playing on Prethi resentment, we stoked tensions among the three clans, leading to a series of clashes. This gave us the excuse to claim we needed to provide security for our enclave. A sardonic smile graced his face. We argue that since the best Prethi fighting men were concentrated on the borders, that our trade center was at risk if there was a raid on the city. The Prethi hetman was so focused on the other clans, he allowed us to bring in several hundred soldiers to ensure the security of our trading houses. Our numbers grew until the enclave included more than 3,000 traders, craftsmen, and their families, and security forces. Tuzer grinned.
Still hard to believe they accepted our story.
Okuya nodded. Indeed. And by orchestrating a chain of events, we arranged for Selfsil and Iwal to attack the Prethi in a series of major raids and inconclusive minor battles, with casualties on all sides, thus weakening the Prethi clan. In a gesture of support, the leader of our mission at that time offered to help the Prethi by bringing in more troops. His smile broadened. Troops on their way to another destination that just happened to come to Cadellium to replenish stores. The Prethi leaders, afraid of being dismembered by the other two clans, agreed, and 2,000 more of our troops disembarked. Kalkin put his hands behind his head and stretched expansively.
They really were dim-witted.
Maybe so, Aquian said. But it was at this point 2 years ago that the five of us came to Cadellium. The threat of our backing the Prethi cooled the fervor of the other two clans, and the three-way truce was well brokered by Administrator Tuzer.
Thank you for the compliment, General Aquian, but it wasn't all that difficult. Neither of the other two clans resisted once their hetman got a look at our men in formation and the artillery demonstrations. Fact north, they didn't know the condition of our men.
Zoffa slapped the tabletop.
Besides being the dregs of our army, they could hardly stand on their feet after months of being crammed in troop ships.
Then maybe Administrator Tuzer does deserve credit for brokering a cessation of fighting based on a bluff, Aquian said. The other three nodded in agreement. Tuzer opened both palms, accepting the praise. Aquian cleared his throat. Naturally, the Prethi expected most of our troops to withdraw. The Hetman wasn't happy when I informed him there was still too much uncertainty, and the troops would remain to protect Narthani citizens. Without bothering to inform the Prethi Hetman, we then filtered additional military and civilian personnel into our enclave. Once the Prethi realized what we were doing and protested, we gave up any pretense and brought our totals up to 4,000 troops and 3,000 civilians. Zolfa shook his head.
I'm just glad they didn't come to their senses earlier.
Aquian raised his eyebrows. Don't forget, Colonel, that during these months, although you mercilessly worked our men into better physical and fighting condition, it was mainly out of sight of the Prethi. Finally, the Prethi headmen and other clan leaders realized they were losing control. After increasing acrimony in our meetings and small clashes between our men and the Prethi, the hetman led an attack on our enclave, one we were prepared for.
the Predi ineptitude at organization and security, along with our paid Cadelli agents, combined to keep us apprised of their every move. When they attacked, we stayed in our enclave until they amassed their fighting men outside our defenses. Then we landed another 2,000 men behind the Predi. In the ensuing battle, we crushed them between our two forces and took control of the Predi province. Any leaders who survived the initial fighting were hunted down and killed, and their families shipped off as slaves to Narthon. Fighting erupted within Predi City and some of the smaller towns, but we put an end to any significant resistance within a month.
An amazing result in so short a time,
Admiral Kalkan remarked.
I remember wondering back then why we didn't move on to the rest of the island if taking down the Predi clan was so easy.
Zalfa frowned.
But, Kalkan raised a hand. No, Zalfa, I don't mean to pass judgment on army strategies. I was just thinking from the deck of my flagship offshore and not on the ground. It was a fleeting thought.
Zalfa grunted.
It wasn't that the Predi weren't brave enough. At least at first. In several fights they continued even after losing over half their men. They simply had no concept of coordination, tactics, picking their ground, of strategic withdrawal. It was charged straight in. By the time we had killed enough of their older leaders and younger, more flexible thinking leaders emerged, it was too late.
Zalfa's right. Okuyan steepled his fingers. It wasn't so much their fighting spirit as inexperience in warfare. However, the result gave us our foothold on Cadellium. Narthani casualties were less than 200 dead, compared with destroying the Predi clan and almost 1,000 dead each for Iwill and Selfsil during previous years of fighting. At a minimal cost, we absorbed one of the Cadellian clan provinces, and two other clans were about to be co-opted as allies. The Selfsil and Iwill clans were shocked at the suddenness of the Predi destruction and belatedly understood their own danger. At separate meetings with the two clan headmen, I explained that although we had inadvertently gotten involved in Cadellium affairs, the die was cast. The trade had proven lucrative to us, and we intended a further increase. However, to justify the investment, we required confidence that our trade center, which now comprised the entire Predi province, would never again be threatened. Yet even an entire province did not provide enough security. And we needed assurances of the friendly status of their two clans by means of formal alliances with them. As an inducement, we offered to aid them in eventually annexing major territory of their immediate neighbors, lands belonging to the Gwilymer and Moorland